There's no right way to build a clock, Fra Corlandon used to say when he was teaching us modern post-reconstitution history. This was his euphemistic way of saying that St. Edhar's praxis had been a little bit crazy. Our consent was nestled in the crook of a river where it dodged around one end of a range of rocky bluffs, the terminus of a mountain range that stretched for hundreds of miles to the northeast and whose glaciers and snowpacks formed the river's headwaters. Just upstream was a series of cataracts. We could hear them at night if the slines weren't making too much noise. Below them, the river, as though resting from all the excitement, ran still and gentle for some distance, curving across a well-drained prairie. Part of that prairie and a mile and a half of the river were encompassed by our walls. Up at the cataract, the river was easily bridged, and so a settlement tended to be there. During some eras, it would grow and engulf our walls, and office workers and skyscrapers would gaze down on the tops of our bastions. At other times, it would ebb and recede to a tiny fueling station or gun emplacement at the river crossing. Our stretch of the river was hazardous, with rust-eaten girders and lumps of moss-covered synthetic stone, the remains of bridges that had been raised at that crossing and, in later ages, collapsed and washed downstream. Most of our land and almost all of our buildings were on the inside of the river bend, but we had claimed a strip on the far bank and built our fortifications there. Walls parallel to the river where it ran straight, bastions where it bent. Three of those bastions housed walls, one each for the Unarian, Decenarian, and Centenarian Maths. The Millenarian gate was up on the mountain and worked differently. Each gate was supposed to swing open and closed at certain times. This had posed a problem for the praxix in that the gates were situated far away and on the opposite side of a river from the clock that was supposed to command the opening. The praxix had done it with water power. Far outside of our walls, upstream of the cataract, therefore at an altitude well above our heads, they had carved a pool, like an open cistern, out of the river's stony course, and made it feed an aqueduct that cut due south toward the Minster, bypassing the cataract, the bridge, and the bend. After rushing through a short tunnel and loping on stone stilts across half a mile of broken terrain, this dove into the ground and became a buried pipe that passed beneath what was now a settled neighborhood of burghers. The water in that pipe, pressurized by gravity, erupted in a pair of fountains from the pond that lay just outside of the day gate. A causeway ran across the middle of that pond, connecting the central square of the burghers' town at its northern end to our day gate at its southern, and passing right between those two fountains. The elevation of the pond was still above that of the river and plain. Drains were plumbed into its bottom and throttled by monumental ball valves of polished granite. One of them fed a series of ponds, canals, and fountains that beautified the primate's compound, and farther downstream, formed part of the barrier between the Unarian and the Decenarian Maths. Three other drains were connected to systems of pipes, siphons, and aqueducts that ran out toward the year, decade, and century gates. Those systems were dry, except at Appert. Now the clock's descending weights had opened two valves and allowed water to rush from the pond to flood the year and decade systems. In some ways, maybe this was a crazy and ramshackle way to do it, but there was one advantage that wasn't obvious to me until that day. The waterworks had been designed to fill up slowly. So after the rite concluded, we were able to spill out of the Minster and follow the water at a brisk walking pace as it charged an aqueduct that ran along beside the seven stairs, skirted the cloister, and reached across the back toward the river. A stone bridge crossed the river there, anchored on the near bank by a round tower, and on the far by a bastion in the consent's outer wall. Within the round tower was a cistern, now being filled by water from the aqueduct, with a pitcher lip poised above the petals of a water wheel. Most of us reached it in time to see the cistern overflow and the wheel begin to turn, accepting energy from the water before exhausting it into the river. By stainless steel gears, the wheel rotated a shaft as thick as my thigh that ran across the bridge, You might mistake it for a very stout railing if you didn't know what it was for. Across the river, inside of the bastion, the shaft drove another set of gears that was connected directly to the gates. Hearing them move, we ran toward them, but slowed as we got closer, not knowing what was about to happen. Well, actually, we had a pretty good idea, but I was still young enough that I could let myself forget about Dyax's rake when I was in love with some idea. Orlo's yarn about a math that floated freely in time, surfing on cross currents of causal domain shear, had really stirred my emotions, and so for a few moments I let my imagination run away and pretended that I lived in such a math and that I really had no idea what might be found outside its gates when they opened. Mobs of jumped-up slines rushing in with pitchforks or Molotovs. Starving ones crawling in to worry potatoes out of the ground. Moshianic pilgrims expecting to see the face of some god or other. Corpses strewn to the horizon. Virgin wilderness. The most interesting moment was when the gap between the gates grew just wide enough to admit a single person. Who would it be? Male or female, old or young, carrying an assault rifle, a baby, a chest of gold, or a backpack bomb.